We're here for oral argument in Harry Franklin Phillips versus the Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections. Marie Louise Samuels Palmer is here for the appellant Phillips. Lisa Marie Lerner is here for the appellee, the secretary. And Ms. Palmer, you may begin when you're ready.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I am actually Marie Louise Samuels Palmer. It's spelled Marie, but pronounced Marie. And I am here on behalf of Mr. Phillips. This case is truly one of those rare cases that warrants habeas relief. The state's case against Mr. Phillips would have failed without the snitch's testimony. The Brady and Giglio violations in this case were so pervasive, shocking, intentional, and material that there can be no doubt that the withheld evidence would have produced a different result under the Brady standard, that the false testimony, there's a reasonable likelihood that the false testimony could have affected the judgment of the jury under Giglio, and that Phillips suffered actual prejudice as the suppression of evidence was so pervasive and so affected defense counsel's strategy and the presentation of false testimony to the jury that the prosecutor's misconduct had a substantial and injurious effect on the jury's verdict under Brecht. The state court's resolution of the claims in this case was unreasonable in three broad ways. The state court's misapprehended the Giglio and Brady materiality standards and misapplied the law to the facts in an unreasonable, objectively unreasonable manner.
Can I ask you just a quick question about the first point you make about the Brady and Giglio standards? Certainly take your point that the state court didn't always sort of hash out which standard it was talking about, but there is some language in the state court's opinion at page 781, where the court says, we find that there is no reasonable probability that the false testimony affected the judgment of the jury. That does sort of call up the Giglio standard, right? So, I don't know, especially under AEDPA, can we say it's contrary to if they at least invoked the right language, do you think?
I think if you look in the context of what the Florida Supreme Court has said about, well, I think there are two points. The first is, I think if you look at the context of what the Florida Supreme Court itself has said about its own misapprehension over the years of the Giglio and Brady standard, and one of those cases that they receded from or clarified, really, is Routley, which is the case that the Phillips court relied on. And the other factor I think that's important is if you look at the post-conviction court's order, that court doesn't even only cites Brady. Doesn't even cite Giglio, and the Florida Supreme Court doesn't seem to concern itself about that in reviewing what the lower court did. So I think that it's fair to say that this, even though I would concede, you're absolutely right, Your Honor, in that there is that bit of language there, and they do cite Giglio, but I would say in the history of it, because of the history of the Florida Supreme Court, that it is that the court really didn't appreciate and didn't recognize that there were these, you know, that there's a different materiality analysis.
I guess I just wonder, is it possible, especially given, it has always struck me that contrary to is sort of like a tougher row to hoe than unreasonable application of. You know, I guess in Williams versus Taylor, the Supreme Court says, hey, contrary to doesn't mean just wrong. It means like sort of diametrically opposed or something. So you've got to show something pretty special. And I just wonder if in this case, despite Routley, the Supreme Court or the Florida Supreme Court sort of like maybe even like dumb luck stumbled its way into the right standard. And I just wonder if we can under AEDPA say that it's truly contrary to if in fact they at least recite the correct standard.
So I would answer that by saying, number one, I don't think they got it right. And I don't think they got the right standard. And I think there's a reason appellate courts have standards, and there's a reason that courts apply them. And the goal is to apply them properly. And I don't think they got that right. But even if, because of AEDPA deference, this court would want to say, They cited Giglio. We're really not sure. We know they have this bad history, but we're not really sure. Either, regardless, they misapplied the law to the facts. And I think if you look at Guzman v. Secretary, Department of Corrections, which is cited extensively in my brief, I think that's another route that is an appropriate route for this court to say that AEDPA deference doesn't apply. The other of the three broad ways that the state court's resolution was wrong, the state court made unreasonable determinations of facts in light of the state court record, and the state courts failed to conduct a cumulative analysis as required by clearly established federal law. The district court as well erred. While the district court rendered a much more thoughtful and detailed opinion than either of the state courts, the district court found AEDPA deference here, even though none was due, and as a result, erred in its Brecht analysis and failed to fully weigh the effect of the suppressed evidence and the resulting perjured testimony. While prosecutor's good faith or bad faith is irrelevant in assessing Brady and Giglio error, there is no mistake here that the suppression of evidence was intentional. The prosecutor cut out parts of the police reports he wanted to hide from Mr. Phillips and then taped pages together so missing paragraphs were undetectable after the document was copied. It is truly shocking what this prosecutor did in this case. It was a time-consuming process to do that.
How do we factor into consideration the state court's determination that, well, these jailhouse informants, they were really impeached at trial. They were impeached as felons and liars. And so even if there was some misconduct on the part of the prosecutors, even the district court recognized that what the prosecutor did in this case was pretty egregious. Their cross-examination was effective. They were impeached as felons, and they were impeached as liars. There was cross-examination upon which the court could rely to determine that maybe they did make up their testimony, and the state courts also seem to really not believe these four informants when they testified or through their affidavits at the evidentiary hearing when they said that he didn't tell me he committed the crime. If state courts didn't believe that, what do we do with that factual determination by the state court? Aren't we required to give that determination deference under AEDPA?
So as I understand the court, you're asking essentially two questions. Was the impeachment cumulative? And secondly, aren't we owed due deference to the state court's credibility findings? So let me answer that. Is that correct? Is that essentially what the court is? So let me answer
it.
Those two sort of two questions. So whether or not the impeachment was cumulative, I think the answer to that question is this court's own opinion in Guzman v. Secretary, Department of Corrections. That in that case, the witness who perjured herself about the money she received, the court found that while she was cross-examined, no court has ever said that just because a witness is cross-examined that automatically any other cross-examination is cumulative. And the Guzman court also pointed out that it's one thing to say that you're a felon. It's another thing to show that you're willing to lie about it or you're willing to lie about something else. And the Phillips was prevented from doing the kind of thorough and effective cross-examination in this case that he should have been able to do because there were so many instances of facts that were hidden, which are set out in the brief. But so, no, I don't think that the additional cross-examination would have been cumulative at all. As far as the lack of credibility of the witnesses, so, yes, a credibility determination is a finding of fact that this court owes deference to, but you're not required to just automatically say, oh, the state court made a credibility determination under AEDPA. We can't fix that. We can't change that, even if we think that's wrong. And so by way of example, One of the credibility determination, well, I think there are two good examples that show that this the state post-conviction court's credibility determination was wrong. One was Larry Hunter's affidavit. So in rejecting Larry Hunter's affidavit, remember that because Larry Hunter pled the Fifth and he wouldn't come and testify because he was invoking his Fifth Amendment right to not perjure himself.
I guess what I'm concerned about is these four jailhouse informants who testified at the trial. At the evidentiary hearing, you had two of them testify and you had two of them submit affidavits. And it seems like the state court made the determination, I don't believe anything you guys are saying at all. So what do we do?
Yes, so I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off.
How do you get around that?
Well, so that's what I'm trying to say. So Larry Hunter presented, there's an affidavit. The state post-conviction court says, I reject that affidavit because it is in conflict with the facts adduced at trial. But that's nonsensical because this is a post-conviction hearing. This is when a witness, under Giglio, Brady, and newly discovered evidence, that's exactly what the testimony is going to be. It's going to be testimony that comes in that is different from what happened at trial. If that's a valid reason, and that's the only reason he rejected Hunter's affidavit, if that's a valid reason to do it, then there is never going to be a valid Giglio recantation or Brady claim because it's always going to be different from that adduced at trial. That was his sole reasoning for rejecting Larry Hunter. When it comes to William Farley, the reason he rejected William Farley's test, he said William Farley wasn't believable. But here's the problem with that finding. We know that William Farley wrote letters. Dates he wrote letters was the day he wrote letters to Waxman saying, you haven't kept your promise. You haven't done what you told me to do. You told me you were going to get me out just like all of the other people, and you told me you were going to give me money and benefit. And that letter was written the day Harry Phillips was sentenced to death. 2 weeks later, he writes another letter to Waxman. This is many, many years before the post-conviction hearing. How does Farley know all of these things and know that 5 years down the road, these are going to be the claims in the post-conviction hearing, and lo and behold, there's documentary evidence that supports those things? So that credibility determination against Farley is inconsistent when you look at the letters that Farley wrote that were in the prosecutor's file. And the state did a pretty good job of muddying the waters on that by saying Farley wrote some letters down the road. Janet Reno looked at the letters and got, you know, said, what's going on here? That was many years down the road. But the two letters that are crucial are those letters that came out the day Phillips was sentenced to death and 2 weeks later. And what happens after he writes those letters? Smith, Detective Smith, goes and sees him in jail, and a few weeks later, he's out. Waxman signs the check for the money that he gets. He gets the check from Waxman. He goes to Waxman's office to get the check, and nobody says a word about it. Nobody says a word about it until years down the road. So those, I think, are two specific examples where the state post-conviction court's credibility determinations were wrong. Another example that was completely wrong is the determination about Scott/Smith, I call him because he had the two last names. The state court said, oh, you know, it wasn't really a problem when he denied that he was a police informant for Metro-Dade Police because the questioning was ambiguous. Well, I urge the court to take the time to carefully look at Smith's pre-trial deposition given December 12th of 1983. It's at Appendix II, Volume 2, and looking specifically at pages 208 to 218 in the record. During that deposition, the defense attorney, Phillips' defense attorney, asks Scott Smith all different ways, what is your connection to Miami-Dade? Are you an informant? Are you working? And Scott Smith, while the prosecutor is sitting in the room during the deposition, Scott Smith is evasive, obfuscates, and downplays anything. He says, nah, I was in the 1960s, maybe, helped out Detective Huff. The 1960s was a long time ago, even in the 1980s when this trial took place. And so to find, if you look at that, the defense attorney tried to figure that out, but he was given false information. It's true that Scott Smith admitted he was a federal agent and was getting paid $1,000 a month, which is a huge amount of money in 1982.
So the state court made a determination that any rewards that were given to these jailhouse informants, the rewards took place after their testimony.
Yes.
And so
they didn't know, but we know that Farley testified.
That's a fact that the state court, a determination that the state court made after an evidentiary hearing. And so tell me, how are we going to get around not giving that factual determination deference?
Yes, so I think the three examples that I've given you are refuted by the record or by logical reasoning, right? Mm-hmm. About Hunter, by logical reasoning, the other two by documents in the record, the deposition of Scott and then the letters of Farley. As far as the money, I think that's a harder push, to be candid. I do think, though, that there's a legitimate argument to be made that we know Farley testified that he saw in the newspaper that there was a $1,000 reward. He thought he was getting a $1,000 reward. That's reflected in his letter, I believe. I don't know exactly. Whatever the letter says is right. But I think he reflects in his letter that he's getting that money. The point of a reward, what is the point of a reward in a criminal case? It's to bring people forward that law enforcement don't know about in order to solve a crime, right? And so how do you do that? You don't do that by hiding the fact that there's a reward. You do that by advertising, we're making a reward. Farley said he saw it in the paper in the article about Mr. Svensson's son and the funeral. And so to say that they didn't know about this $1,000 reward, I think is hard to, I think, find believable. But put that aside. I don't think, even if you find that's not shown, you know, through AEDPA deference, that one part of it can't be shown, there's plenty more. And I see that I'm getting close to the end of my time, so I really want to focus on this cutting and pasting of the report and what that hid. So we know that the cutting and pasting of the reports hid the fact that Hunter himself called the prosecutor, that Farley spoke with the police officer for an hour, with Detective Smith for an hour and a half before his taped statement, and that Scott was sent by Detective Smith with the $20 bill to go talk to Phillips' mother and sister.
Just so I'm clear, did the redaction, all the cutting and pasting, also show with respect to Scott that officers were dispatched to his preliminary hearing or sentencing hearing or something?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was very significant because that happened the day before Scott Smith talked to Phillips. And so these were intentional, shocking. I can tell you, you know, I'm sure the court, you see all sorts of things. I've seen a lot of things as a defense attorney as well. And this is just shocking, what the prosecutor did in this case. And the district court saw it, and he recognized it, and he recognized how unapologetic the prosecutor was about this egregious misconduct.
But even though we might agree that there were violations of ethical rules and other things, and that it was an unethical thing to do, how can we say that the state court's decision to credit Waxman's testimony was you know, there's a presumption of correctness given to state court's factual findings. So he would have to show by clear and convincing evidence.
Well, so I think, let me answer that in two ways. One, the state courts never addressed the cutting and pasting of the reports, neither the post-conviction court or the Florida Supreme Court. They do credit Waxman's testimony about, well, I didn't know I was going to give them the money until after or shortly before, and I didn't tell them. And I didn't realize I was going to, you know, end somebody's life sentence and get him out of jail and give a armed rapist, you know, 5 years probation. It was just, I was so overcome by how much they did for me. So the state courts did credit that testimony, but Waxman admits that he cut and pasted this, and this is beyond an ethical violation. This is a violation of criminal discovery rules in Florida. Florida has very liberal criminal discovery rules. But I think what's important to note, it's not only that there was not adequate cross-examination on these points, it thwarted Harry Phillips' ability to investigate exactly what was going on. What would the jury have thought if they had known all of this that was going on, not only the facts that were hidden, but the fact that the prosecutor in this case hid them? And so if you look at, again, Guzman v. Secretary, there are many reasons to overcome AEDPA deference here. This case is truly one of those rare cases. Harry Phillips, the state would not even have been able to get a guilty verdict against Phillips without the snitches. There was simply not enough evidence. There would have been a judgment of acquittal.
Before you sit down, I just have a question about the record. Did trial counsel have access to the transcript of Farley's recorded interview before trial?
Yes, he had the interview. I believe so. Yes, Your Honor.
Did the transcript that he had access to show what we're calling the pre-interview or no?
No, not at all. You couldn't tell at all from the transcript that trial counsel received.
Well, in the transcript, Detective Smith asked, in the pre-interview, you said something about being behind a building. So Phillips' counsel at least knew that there had been a pre-interview based on that statement, didn't
they? I stand corrected. I didn't realize there had been that in there. But yes, so trial counsel knew somewhat, but he didn't know the extent of it. And I think what's important, and I'm going into my rebuttal time, but
what do you mean he knew somewhat?
I'm sorry.
What do you mean by he knew somewhat?
Well, I guess for what you're saying, if he knew from that statement, if there's that in the transcript, which I was not aware of, then I guess it's fair to say that trial counsel would have known there was some kind of pre-interview. But trial counsel didn't have that 1.5 hour part that Waxman cut out.
Okay.
And I think what's important is we know that that was important cross-examination piece because Waxman didn't want anybody to know about it. When trial counsel tried to cross-examine Farley about it at trial, he was fumbling around because he didn't have that police report. And then Waxman argues in closing argument, we know Farley's telling the truth because he knows all these details that no one else would know. And how else could he know it? Well, the answer as to how else he could have known it, and which is what Farley explains, is that Smith gave him that information. So I see I'm going into my rebuttal time, and I would like to...
You've reserved your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Palmer. We'll hear from Ms. Lerner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
May it please the Court, Lisa Marie Lerner with the Attorney General's Office, representing the Secretary of the Department of Corrections for Florida. Under Giglio and Brady, it is the defense's burden to show that the findings of facts of the Florida courts were unreasonable by presenting clear and convincing evidence. And Phillips failed to do that in his habeas petition and in this court.
Can I ask you to address what for me are sort of the three most, and just speaking solely for myself, the three most problematic aspects of this case? The redaction, the cutting and pasting is indefensible, and I assume that you're not going to try to defend it. But it interacts with three different sort of factual pieces of the case. One, in my mind, with respect to Scott/Smith, that the officers did go to talk at, you know, a sentencing hearing, which seems to me more than just sort of your standard operating procedure letter to the judge to, you know, to urge leniency. Two, with respect to Farley, this bit about the pre-interview. And three, with respect to Hunter, whether or not he was a willing witness, you know, who came forward or instead was a reluctant witness. All three of those things, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but if I understand the record correctly, all three of those things were cut out before the document was pasted back together. Documents were pasted back together.
Yes, that is my understanding as well, Your Honor.
So that's pretty grim, right? That's pretty grim.
Yes. In terms of Scott, Scott testified at the trial that he was a federal informant, and he also testified that he worked with Detective Howe, who was not related to this Phillips case at all. And he had known Detective Howe since 1965. That's part of the trial transcript. And that whenever he got information, he would call Detective Howe and tell him to check it out. The jury heard all of that. And so if the prosecutor cut that out, the defense actually knew that from the pretrial depositions as well as from his trial testimony. It's my understanding that
So why cut it out? Why did he need to cut it out?
I cannot say what went through that man's mind, Your Honor. He said at the evidentiary hearing that it was not discoverable. It was just work product, and therefore he did not turn it over. I do not defend his assertion. However, that is what he said. And the trial court, in listening to him, believed him. However, two other witnesses the trial court also believed at the evidentiary hearing. That was Detective Greg Smith and Detective Hebding. Detective Hebding was one of the two, along with Detective Smith, who interviewed Farley in that taped interview. But I want to finish with Scott, and then I will go on to that. It's my understanding that it was Sapp and Howe who showed up at Scott's preliminary hearing before Scott encountered Philip in the prison. They are unrelated to this case, and those are the two detectives that Scott was always working with since 1965, which he told the jury and the defense knew. In terms of showing up at his sentencing, Detective Smith and Detective Hebding testified at the evidentiary hearing that came up after the testimony and after trial. Again, the trial court credited their testimony that they had not promised Scott that they would do that, but that came up afterwards because of all the difficulty that Scott went through pending this trial. He was threatened, he was beaten up, and so on. Moving on to Mr. Farley. As I said, Detectives Hebding and Greg Smith were contacted by the Lake Butler facility saying that Farley wanted to talk to them. So they went to the Lake Butler facility together to interview Farley. And they did, according to Detective Smith and Farley, a 15 to 20 minute pre-interview. The Florida Supreme Court said it was an hour and a half, but when I went through and looked at it, Farley and both Greg Smith said it was 15 to 20 minutes. Be that as it may, there was this unrecorded pre-interview.
So where did the Florida Supreme Court get the hour and a half then?
There was testimony that the whole interview was an hour and a half.
There was testimony by who?
By Detective Smith.
Okay.
And Farley, and during the trial too.
They testified at the evidentiary hearing that before the tape recorder was turned on, they spoke for an hour and a half?
No. From what I saw, Detective Smith testified, and Farley too, at the evidentiary hearing, that there was a period of 15 to 20 minutes before the taped interview that was not taped.
But where's the hour and a half come from at the Florida Supreme Court?
I don't know. It's my understanding that the entire interview was about an hour and a half. I think the Florida Supreme Court was in error on that, but I don't know where they got that.
I thought Smith, Detective Smith, said that the pre-interview lasted approximately 90 minutes, that he testified to that.
I think that was Detective Hebding. When I went through the testimonies, it was Detective Hebding who said that, I believe.
Okay, and so that we're clear now, the defense attorney did not know that they spoke with Farley for a considerable period of time before the tape recorder was turned on. Is that clear?
No. The defense attorney did know because he deposed both Detective Smith and Detective Hebding pre-trial. And in those depositions, they testified, not necessarily the amount of time, but they did a pre-interview with Farley to see why he wanted to talk to them. And after they did the little pre-interview, they then taped his statement. That was in the deposition. That's why at trial, the defense attorney knew about the pre-interview.
Now, let's back up now. Farley at trial testified that he didn't speak with Detective Smith before the tape recorder was turned on. That's what he testified to at trial, right?
Yes, and that was wrong.
That was wrong. And so, all right, so if that's wrong and the defense attorney didn't know about it, not only could he not cross-examine Farley about it, he also could not cross-examine Detective Smith about it either.
But begging your pardon, Your Honor, your premise is incorrect. The defense attorney did know about it.
Okay.
He knew about it from the pretrial depositions of the detectives. And in fact, part of his questioning alluded to the pretrial interview.
Okay.
Additionally, the Florida Supreme Court determined that Farley's lie or misstatement, or however you wish to categorize it, mm-hmm. about the whole interviewing tape was immaterial because it did not go to impeaching him further.
Before you go any further, was there anything in the police reports about Farley being interviewed by Detective Smith or any other detective before the tape recorder was turned on?
My understanding of the record, Detective Smith had put that in the report, and that was part of what this prosecutor cut out.
He cut out that part about the interview with Farley before the tape recorder was turned on.
That's my understanding. The police reports that were given to
defense counsel before the trial. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And the Florida Supreme Court determined that Farley's misstatement was not material. There were a number of other evidence which the district court alluded to, which supported these inmates' testimony. The 38 caliber bullets found at the murder scene all came from a 38 Magnum revolver, which was the gun that Scott saw Phillips with in 1980. And also there's another witness that was not mentioned in our briefs. His name is Tony Smith. Tony Smith saw Phillips at a bar between the time that the house was shot in and the murder. And
just ask a general question. I mean, it's clear here that the prosecutor redacted police reports in order to avoid the defense attorney obtaining exculpatory information that would be helpful to Mr. Phillips during the trial. Is that right?
Yes.
And so what I'm... Then isn't it odd that the Florida Supreme Court doesn't even address the redactions at all? What do we make of that? I mean, we don't address the redactions at all. That's bothersome, isn't it?
Well, it would have been more helpful if it had been a more substantial opinion, more in line with what the district court's order was. However, under the standards this court is bound to in a habeas petition, since the Florida Supreme Court deemed all of this alleged Giglio violations immaterial, it must have done so with this as well. And also the state respectfully does not concede that all of the redactions were helpful to the defense.
When we compare the facts in this case to the facts in our prior decision in Guzman versus the Florida Secretary of the Department of Corrections. I mean, these cases are very similar.
Respectfully,
and the reasoning in Guzman is directly on point regarding the suppression of evidence that's favorable to a defense attorney, where you have, like you have here, unapologetic prosecutorial misconduct. And you've got, I mean, the state's entire case was based on the testimony of these four informants, right?
No, it wasn't, and that's what I was trying to explain. It wasn't.
Tell me, what was the other evidence in this case that the state relied upon?
You have the 38 caliber revolver bullets found at the murder scene. 38 caliber revolver bullets were also found in the house that was shot up and about a week before the murder. The firearm expert testified that the two sets of bullets were consistent. The ones in the house were too mutilated for 100% positive identification, but he said that they were consistent. It had the same turns, and it had the same number of lands and grooves.
So the gun was never found, right?
No, it was not. However, Tony Smith saw Phillips with a 38 caliber Magnum revolver a few days after the shooting into the house and before the murder. And when Tony Smith saw him, Phillips admitted to shooting into the house because the parole officers were violating him. He testified that Phillips said, "I missed her, but I'm going to get them."
Came in through who?
Tony Smith. Okay. And Phillips also said that he was going to rectify the situation. Phillips also told Detective Smith that, given the number of shots fired, couldn't there have been two shooters? The number of shots fired was never released, and that was the first thing Phillips said to Detective Smith, the first thing when he first met him. He also said that you don't have any witnesses, and he made the statement, "You're lucky you caught me when you did. Otherwise, I would have killed every motherfucking parole agent in that office." He also testified that nobody saw me shoot that motherfucker. Excuse my language. But those are statements by Phillips to Detective Smith. Everyone knew about the parole violation. There was a lot of testimony about that. There were four civilian witnesses who heard the gunshots, who came and testified. Two of those witnesses testified about the direction and in front of which building this person went. Hunter knew that information, knew the direction, knew there were bushes there, knew it was a doctor's office. That was corroborated by these lay witnesses who had nothing to do with the inmates. The fact that there were two volleys of shots, three and then five, Hunter knew that. And lay witnesses confirmed that. They were not involved with the police or were inmates in any way.
Well, I don't want to interrupt your narrative, but just to make sure I understand sort of the point you're ultimately aiming at, is this, in your view, where Judge Jordan for the district court sort of ultimately kind of netted out? Like, he seemed pretty offended by the redaction as well, I think it's fair to say. Thought that at least there might have been a Giglio error or two here, but that in any event, under Brecht, you just sort of like couldn't pierce the harmless error analysis?
Yes, I submit both that in the state's opinion, Phillips could not meet the materiality requirement under Giglio or Brady, given this other evidence, and definitely not under Brecht, because there was more evidence. Another thing, I know this court is concerned about the redactions about Hunter contacting the state attorney directly rather than being a shy witness who was just dragged into this situation unwillingly. That would be proper impeachment that the defense could bring out in trial and was prevented from doing so by this. However, I submit that still cannot show materiality because during Hunter's testimony himself and in contradiction to the affidavit that was submitted in the evidentiary hearing, Hunter had notes and letters telling him, this is what you say to help my alibi. Those notes and letters had Phillips' fingerprints on them. The defense stipulated to that at trial. They were also in Phillips' handwriting. The defense stipulated to that at trial. So that corroborated Hunter's testimony that Phillips talked to him in the law library multiple times about trying to develop an alibi. And that's independent physical evidence, which
have a stronger claim with a stronger argument with regard to the Brady claim. But if there's other evidence in the case that the jury could have relied upon to convict Mr. Phillips, but there's a different materiality standard with regard to Giglio, if the evidence that we're concerned about, the lack of information that's given to the defense attorney that could have been used to impeach the four witnesses, if it could have produced a different result. If we rely on Guzman, doesn't Phillips have a stronger Giglio claim?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the situation in Guzman was very different. Giving $500 to a crack addict is a lot of money, especially back decades ago. And that's a very different type of impeachment and motivation to lie than whether or not someone contacted the state attorney or his cellmate did. It's apples and oranges. And the same with Farley. Farley's post-conviction testimony was, no, Phillips always said he was innocent, and I just made the whole thing up because the police told me all the details. However, we have an evidentiary hearing where those very police officers testified.
Unlike Guzman, in this case, you got four informants who testified against Mr. Phillips, who had promises of inducements and rewards that the defense attorney didn't know about. You had four testify at the trial. And wasn't there some other evidence that was used to convict Mr. Guzman other than the impeachment evidence?
Your Honor,
why would we have different reasoning in this case than we had in Guzman?
Because respectfully, your premise is incorrect. We don't have a situation where the defense didn't know about the promises made. And the state courts made those factual findings. The state attorney and the two detectives came in at the evidentiary hearing and said, when we met these people, especially Farley and Scott, we told them we can't make you any promises. And that's what they said at trial. And the items that we discussed previously, the reward money and showing up at a probation or parole violation or sentencing, that all developed after trial, according to these witnesses who were credited by the state court because of the trouble these individuals went through, including spending more time in custody than was necessary in order to testify at trial. And that was believed. The statements by Farley were discounted altogether because he did, in fact, know items, specific details about the shooting that he couldn't have found out from anyone else but the shooter. For this court to grant Giglio relief or Brady relief on this, you would have to discredit the factual findings of the state court and say that the state attorney who admitted misconduct, he didn't try to evade it, he admitted it, and two detectives lied and gave information to these informants.
husband.
But this is a very different situation. Further, as was brought out at the evidentiary hearing, Farley was about to go to state prison on another charge. And he was trying to get out from being labeled a snitch in prison. And this was part of his strategy. He was questioned on that, and he admitted that, yes, snitches have problems. And as I said, his testimony at the evidentiary hearing contradicted the trial itself.
Well, what about Ms. Palmer's argument that, of course, it contradicts the trial? That's what happens in post-conviction in an evidentiary hearing. That's the whole point.
But it contradicts the lay witnesses, too. I mean, how would Farley know what direction he came from and passing in front of the bushes? That's not really details that even the police could give, because the lay witnesses said they saw an object. They couldn't even say if it was a man or woman moving in a certain direction. And at trial, the prosecutor put this together, and from the way the bullet shot and this and that, they developed the way the person had to be moving. But Farley knew that, and it was in his statement to the detectives Smith and Hebding during his first interview. So his later statements are contradicted by that. Additionally, Phillips admitted to shooting a gun and that he had a GSR on him and he had been tested for it. And granted, each of these are small facts, but they add up to a situation where it does not support either the Brady issues brought up in post-conviction or the Giglio. Given this other evidence, Phillips cannot show the necessary materiality that's required even under Giglio.
How do we, in our precedent, discourage this type of prosecutorial misconduct if we, as you argue, point to other evidence in the case that establishes a harmless error? Yes, the prosecutor engaged in what I think Judge Jordan said was egregious misconduct. However, there's other evidence in the case that the jury could have relied upon to convict Mr. Phillips, other than the testimony of these jailhouse snitches. If that's the case, if that's going to be our decision every time, how do we discourage prosecutors from engaging in this sort of conduct in the future?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if that's going to be your decision as a court every time. However, in the fact-specific situation here, mm-hmm. the state submits that it must be your stance, given the credibility findings of the state court. I have known...
Maybe that's why we reached the decision that we did in Guzman.
But $500 to a crack addict that was not disclosed is very different than whether or not the witness called the state attorney or the detectives contacted him. As I said, they're very different. However, I have seen in other opinions in courts where the court specifically calls out the prosecutor and outlines the behavior and says this is absolutely not to be done. And that would be a way of doing it as well, because the state of Florida is interested in justice and maintaining it. And to throw out a first-degree murder conviction because the court is angry at a prosecutor's actions, which did not result in changing the verdict.
Not just angry at a prosecutor's action, but supporting the Constitution of the United States.
Yes, Your Honor.
Giving a defendant a fair trial, right to a fair trial. a Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial.
Submits that given the facts of this situation, Mr. Phillips did have a fair trial, and that while there were irregularities, violations perhaps of the discovery, that did not affect and could not have affected the judgment of the jury given the totality of the evidence in this case.
Can I ask you a question just to help me get my head around how it is that the materiality standard, either of Brady or of Giglio, but more specifically Giglio, and the Brecht harmless error prejudice, actual prejudice analysis map onto one another? I mean, they don't seem all that different. And it seems like the thrust of your position, and I think the thrust of Judge Jordan's decision for the district court was, there's some really bad conduct here. Not sure it made a difference in the end. And I'm trying to figure out that not made a difference in the end thing could run to materiality, which you've been arguing, or it could run to harmlessness under Brecht. And I'm trying to figure out sort of how those two standards map onto one another. Like, for instance, if we conclude under Brecht that this did not result in actual prejudice, which I take to mean from Guzman, the alleged error must have had a substantial and injurious effect on the influence or influence in determining the jury's verdict. If we conclude that that standard isn't satisfied and it's therefore harmless under Brecht, do we even get to any of this Giglio materiality stuff, or does the Brecht analysis sort of subsume it?
Under the case law, the Brecht analysis can subsume it because the court doesn't necessarily even have to grapple with the Giglio if the Brecht is not met. And there are a number of cases which have found that.
Okay. And the Brecht analysis is de novo, right? There's nothing to defer to in the state court.
Yes, because the state court did not do such an analysis. If there are no further questions, the state asks this court to affirm the denial of the habeas petition.
Thank you, Ms. Lerner. Ms. Palmer?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address some of the facts that my opposing counsel addressed in terms of the Brecht analysis and the weight of the evidence against Mr. Phillips. So, there can be no Brecht error when there is a strong case against a defendant. But when there is a case here that hinges essentially on circumstantial evidence, but for the testimony of these four snitches, and I take Judge Wilson's point, I think is very well made. The fact that there were four snitches here is worse than the one in Guzman, because they're feeding off of each other, but if they're all tainted, then it makes the error even greater. And why did the prosecutor want four snitches here? Because he knew how weak his case was. And respectfully, and of course this court can look at the record, it's voluminous, so if I misspeak, I would urge the court, you know, to do its own looking at the record for the precision of these facts, as I know the court would. But my recollection of what the testimony was about the weapon is different from what opposing counsel said, in that it was not as connected as it was. There was testimony about this shooting into the probation officer's home about a week before the murder of Mr. Svensson.
Which probably shouldn't have come in.
Exactly, Your Honor. It shouldn't have come in.
But it did.
It did. And, you know, and as far as I know, Mr. Phillips was arrested for that, but was never convicted and tried for that, to the best of my knowledge. And so it shouldn't have come in. But I don't think that the testimony about the bullets was really linked at all. They narrowed it down to five different types of guns, as I remember, and that the bullets that were shot at the house were so mangled that they couldn't make those comparisons. And, you know, I'm always happy to say that certain forensic evidence is unreliable. I'm a defense attorney. But the ability for experts to actually look at guns and see whether they are bullets, to see if they came from the same weapon, is pretty legitimate. And they really weren't able to do that here. Narrowing it down to five different types of guns, how many guns are there in the United States? A lot. So narrowing it down to five different types, that's not five different guns, that's five different types.
What about like statements attributed to Mr. Phillips by, I can't remember the name of the witness, that I'm going to shoot him?
Those statements, as I recall, were not exactly as said. There was a statement, he was with in the bar, and he says, I'm going to get a gun, I'm going to do those things. But, you know, that's still not enough to convict him. There's certainly, you know, there are some bad facts here. That's often the case in wrongful conviction cases, right? There's always something that leads the police to look at the case. It was reasonable for them to think that Phillips was a suspect. But I think they leapt and concluded he was the guy, and they weren't able to prove it other than through snitches. Phillips never confessed to Detective Smith. It's kind of like, almost like a My Cousin Vinny. When you read what Phillips said to Smith, like, it's almost like, I would have killed, you know, he's swearing and so on, but it's not really, he kept saying, I didn't do it. That part was left out. I didn't do it. He kept saying I didn't do it. He made these statements in anger. And I know that, Phillips has an IQ of 75. And while he was unable to...
Is that in the record?
That is in the record, Your Honor. Yes, it absolutely is.
There's nothing wrong with relying on jailhouse snitches to convict a defendant accused of a crime. The critical determination is whether or not... there's evidence that they're lying.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's the distinction here, is that, yes, there will be informants in cases, and sometimes that's the only way a prosecutor can bring justice to a case. This was a very, very significant case. Think about it. You know, this was essentially a law enforcement officer who was shot. There were no witnesses. It was a big case at the time, and I know when I started as a young lawyer that I used to think in the big cases, everybody would be so, so careful to get it right. But really what happens in reality is the pressure to get a conviction sometimes leads prosecutors like Mr. Waxman to cheat. And, you know, Mr. Waxman, may he rest in peace, is long dead. So an opinion that criticizes Mr. Waxman isn't going to stop Mr. Waxman.
And I'm sorry if I don't remember this from the record. Is there evidence in the record that this was a more pervasive practice, or was this idiosyncratic to this?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Sorry, the cutting and pasting, which I think we all find so off-putting and potentially wildly unconstitutional, is there evidence in the record that was a more pervasive practice of this prosecutor's office, or was that just this knucklehead who was doing it?
I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I don't know if it was the practice of that office at the time. I don't recall exactly what, off the top of my head, what Mr. Waxman said about that. I mean, he didn't admit that he...
Well, he says, didn't he say that he does it all the time?
He said, exactly, Your Honor. He said he did it all the time, and he said it wasn't wrong. So he
did... Routine?
He said it was
routine practice.
Mm-hmm. And... Exactly. And he never admitted that he did anything wrong. He said, it's not wrong. It's what I do. And, you know, I think we all agree. Everybody's agreed. It was wrong. I think some other facts that in terms of the weight of the case, the alibi letters from Hunter, there's never been a dispute that Mr. Phillips was involved with those alibi letters. But if you look at what Hunter said about that, well, two things you need to look at. One is Hunter had an alibi. He told the police where he was. They went to check it out. He picked his sister up from work at the library. Law enforcement was able to confirm that the time he picked his sister up was the time she got off work. The sister confirmed she was picked up. There was taking the kids to the park, niece and nephew or sister's children to the park. And then he went home. He went to a game room back, I guess, in the old days when you did video games, outside your home. And then he went to the Winn-Dixie, and there was a receipt from the Winn-Dixie, albeit it was at 9:15. This murder, they were able to pinpoint I think 8:35 or 8:25, but whatever the record says at the time. So how that came about is that Hunter said, I've been to that Winn-Dixie. I can say I was there for you. And so Phillips wrote the letters explaining what he was wearing and what he bought at the Winn-Dixie. The receipts actually corroborated that. So I don't think that evidence is necessarily negative evidence against Phillips. So I think that this case, I think that Judge Jordan was mistaken in his Brecht analysis because he gave so much deference to the state court in finding that he couldn't find these Brady and Giglio errors. And then I think he failed to take into account the weakness of the case. Here's another fact, I think, that supports that this case was weak. The death verdict for Mr. Phillips was 7-5. And that's a very interesting fact because there was virtually no penalty phase in this case. He subsequently gets a new penalty phase down the road. But that 7-5 verdict had to be, I submit to the court, it's reasonable to discern that 7-5 penalty phase verdict was because the jurors had some residual doubt. There's no other explanation for it. Harry Phillips was not presented as a sympathetic figure in his first trial, in his first penalty phase.
Well, so, we don't know what we're going to do with this case, but my question is, what relief are you requesting? Let's say we agree with you with regard to the Giglio claim. What relief are you requesting? Where does the case go? If we agree with you, I'm not saying that we're going to. We have not conferred. Does it go back to the district court for something?
No, Your Honor. I think that what this court should do, and I know it's a lot to ask. It's an old murder case. Murder cases are always hard. Someone died, and I'm mindful of that. But I think that this court should reverse. That Harry Phillips did not have a fair trial. Florida leads the country in wrongful convictions in death penalty cases. It's number one. And we know that snitch testimony is often a big part of wrongful convictions. And so what I would submit to the court is that Brady and Giglio's overriding concern is not with the fault of the prosecutor, although there is much to fault here, but with the justice of the finding of guilt. Almost 100 years ago, in 1935, the Supreme Court in Mooney v. Holohan made clear that deliberate deceptions of a court and jurors by the presentation of known false evidence is incompatible with rudimentary demands of justice. Rudimentary demands. The manner in which the prosecution obtained the guilty verdict and death sentence against Harry Phillips is incompatible with rudimentary demands of justice. It should not be allowed to stand. AEDPA is not a bar to relief in this case. This case is different, and this court should reverse.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Court is adjourned.